Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
It's the Renegade Report.
And we are back. Welcome back, John Robbie Jr. Back to reality.
Welcome back, Beyonce's biggest fan. How are you doing?
Supremely better. Oh, sorry. Supremely better. One can't complain. Looking forward to our guest speaking today.
Yeah, so as always, a great guest lined up. You think it can't get better, and then it does. So he's nodding in approval. It's always a good thing. Yeah, we like to butter them up before we let them on, and then we find they're very pliable that way. So our guest today is Franz Kronier. He is the CEO of the Institute of Race Relations, who have been called everything from a liberal left-leaning think tank to a right-wing think tank. I don't think the labels bother them too much. Franz educated in South Africa, went to high school here, then joined the police, the good police. Those are the guys after 94. Got a bit confused because, you know, they kept telling them they were a force, and then they became a service, and, you know, then they all kinds of weird stuff, which we can get into if we need to. He tells me he went to the United States and actually taught people to horse ride, and then decided, no, that's not such a great idea. So he became a lumberjack. And today he is the world's most qualified sort of local policy lumberjack. So, Franz, I hope that is a fair introduction.
It's amazing. When I go and talk at sort of sophisticated places, how often I find the person that's introducing me skips over, I think, what are the most important parts of the CV and goes to the sort of academic qualifications. It's completely wrong, because it's those other experiences that actually prepare you to do the kind of work that I do today, far more than anything else you're going to pick up at a university.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken about, you know, degrees have value, but it's all the stuff around that, and just having a degree doesn't mean anything.
Well, the degree's required often to get the jobs in this field. Not with us, by the way. We're quite careful now. If you look at some of our job ads, we don't actually specify qualifications. We look for people, and some of our most successful people have actually never been to university and have worked in the policy field. And very often, I think the joke in the place is that the more years someone has spent at somewhere like Wits or the University of Johannesburg, and these days the University of Cape Town, the harder job we're going to have to bring them back to reality, to a point that they can actually be a functioning policy analyst in a country like South Africa. So very often we'd actually prefer someone to have as little tertiary education as possible, although later in their careers, if they move into other organizations, getting to banks and things, then these quite silly artificial hurdles are put in front of them. If you don't have that qualification, then how can you possibly fulfill a particular role at a certain level of seniority?
What's your take on why we've got this sort of quasi-socialist, communist sort of vibe happening at all our universities? And it's not a new thing.
I think it's that the policies of a society are a reflection of its dominant ideas. And I think the right wing of any debate, and I mean right wing in the best sense of the word, sort of traditional conservatism, are very, very bad in any society at defending their own turf, making a case for themselves. They tend to surrender the field to the leftist opposition. And the dominance that the leftist opposition in that debate, and that battle of ideas, it's a terribly important concept, that dominance the left gets in the battle of ideas gets reflected in areas such as on university campuses and the like. Again, my earlier point, why we actually get a concern we have in hiring young analysts is the number of years they might have spent on some of our university campuses and the difficulty they're going to have in coming back to the real world after that.
Yeah, I mean, The left has completely sealed off universities since the 1970s, one could argue. But Franz, tell me more about your organization. So Institute of Race Relations, everyone seems to know the name. Many do not really know what you do. Please, can you give us a bit of a brief history and explanatory note on what you do?
We're a think tank. We exist to influence the decisions taken by people who take definitive decisions about South Africa. That's our role. We try to get into the public mind, though. It's totally pointless to run around chasing cabinet ministers, telling them to do something differently. Public policy is a reflection of public opinion, and we try and turn public opinion in the direction of relatively right-wing conservative ideas, and again, in the best sense of the term.
That's very different to somewhere like, for instance, the US, where you would lobby the equivalent of a cabinet minister there in terms of a Congress member or a Senate member. Here, doesn't really happen. You can't bar politicians.
There's not a very established lobbying industry in South Africa. To the extent that you might see in Washington. The trouble here is that you can't go and find a backbencher type of MP and get him to change his mind, because that chap is totally beholden to the party he represents, regardless of whether it's the official opposition or the African National Congress. And he's not going to change his mind. You can't even struggle even to get cabinet ministers to take decisions on their own. Policy is made within the African National Congress. Everything else is a subcommittee of the ruling party, parliament, the president's office, and whatever else. And you have to get into the upper levels of the decision-making center of the African National Congress to influence policy if you wanted to be a lobbyist. Very difficult to do. The other way around is equally difficult but far more productive. That's that you try and shift public opinion. You try and turn public attitudes. That creates pressure, and politicians tend to follow pressure, and politicians often tend to act in line with public opinion. So we'll often say to companies that might approach us and say they've got a particular problem, so there's no short-term solution. The only solution is a long-term one, to invest in turning public opinion. So that's what we do as a think tank. We try and shift public opinions in the direction of private sector-driven economic growth, free people, make their own decisions. A small federal type of government would be the ideal for us. As specifics, we would advocate, for example, that communities should be able to elect the station commanders of their police stations at local government elections. There shouldn't be a public education system, one run by government. There should be school vouchers instead, and every parent can receive a voucher. All schools should be privatized. They can be given to communities, can buy them. Big private education companies can buy them, churches, civil society groups. And you use your voucher to enroll your child at that school. We sit very close to the libertarian line. The history of the
that's very much the libertarian point of view. So, sorry, the history of the organization, because this sounds not just like race relations. So tell us how we got to our name and where we started.
We established in the 1920s. It's really a response to union in South Africa, which has happened about a decade earlier, and specifically in the Western Cape, the mixed voters role, which has been abandoned, and various protest movements grow out of that decision. These come together in forming the South African Institute of Race Relations in 1929. From the beginning, a very unique approach. It's not going to be a typical type of activist organization, runs around with banners in the streets and organized marches. It's going to do something actually far more sophisticated. It's going to produce very high quality social and economic research and information. It's going to inject that information into the bloodstream of the society. And it's going to use that as its unique contribution to fighting racial injustice in the society. And of course, for the first 60 or so years, the issues are very much racial. And the Institute develops a very broad front of policy expertise. And the only reason for that is the broad fronts of policies that were affected by racial policies.
So in terms of shifting public opinion, would you say that the Institute of Race Relations were part of shifting that public opinion, which, for example, made the referendum on sort of apartheid go one way or another?
Oh, very certainly. It probably became the most prominent anti-apartheid think tank, which is unique for what's actually a conservative organization. There, in a book that, that may be released later this year, we will talk a little bit about that history. And what will come out is that the Institute played a very direct role in seeking to shift white public opinion to the point that white South Africa realized that there was a lot to gain from a negotiated settlement and a different dispensation for the country. Had de Klerk not known that he was going to win his referendum, that yes vote, he couldn't have called it. And a lot of the Institute's work, certainly in the in right throughout from the 20s, but especially in the 20 years I say leading up to the 1990s, was directed at shifting white public opinion on the one hand, and also aimed very much at shifting opinion within the liberation movements away from what would certainly have been failed Afro-socialist policies towards a more conservative type of macroeconomic policy that later this, in this discussion I'll tell you I think the ANC was adopting in the mid-1990s, now abandoned, may go back to again.
So what's interesting is that you have a think tank that is trying to shift public opinion on principles, not ideology, so to speak. So you don't mind picking up principles that are, say, libertarian or not libertarian, but you are interested in how they work. So you're interested in the outcome of policy, and you will adopt policy that works for economic growth and freedom and things like that.
Look, if we're not ideologues, it's certainly something that I try and press upon the organization, I think my colleagues get it, is that we've got to be able to show results, real results. And results have to improve people's standard of living and the amount of freedom that person or individual has. And if we achieve those two things, we're being successful. We're pragmatic. If a policy is working fairly well, even if it doesn't extend all the way into the depths of a libertarian ideal, there's no reason to change it or fight with it or change it simply because of what it represents. And I think that all our interventions are very much geared at securing direct, short, medium, and long-term results. And those results will improve people's standard of living most of the time, through affording those people far more control over their own lives.
So I just want to go through a few of your policies that have been written by some of your fellows and that's been published in the media. So a big issue has cropped up regarding BEE. I mean, there's new regulations stating that now they'll look at individuals only, not quotas in general, whereas the Institute has a different perspective on that. You got EED. Can you just tell us what the difference is and why race may not be such a good proxy for poverty, so to speak?
Well, simply because poverty is a better proxy for poverty than race. You don't need a proxy. You can measure poverty. We've been very critical of the racial basis of empowerment policy right from the beginning. And it's won us very few friends initially, although it's winning us more now. A position entirely consistent with our work out of the 1920s, and we think it's bizarre in some respects that a society that fought so courageously against race-based policies would adopt them so quickly when that society became formally liberated, which in many respects it was in 1994. There are two criticisms of BE and affirmative action policy generally. The one is that racial basis of policy in principle is the wrong approach. The second is that it simply doesn't work. We're sitting with a youth unemployment rate of 50% after 15 years of empowerment policies. We can rack up, my analyst can do it, the hundreds of billions of rands that have moved through BE deals. There's a far better approach. And we call it EED, or Economic Empowerment for the Disadvantaged. And it's got two differences to BEE policy. The first, it's not doesn't look for a proxy to identify its beneficiaries. It looks at your socioeconomic circumstances. Simply does a means test on them. And an excellent means test is where your parents at university. The second thing is it's not an output-focused empowerment policy. The current policies have spawned an entire industry of auditors and BEE practitioners, many of them white-owned, which is a great irony of our history. A colleague tells me the story about attending a seminar where the white owner of the BE firm was training black executives on how to make their own companies BE compliant, which really is perhaps the most grotesque example of where current empowerment policy is leading. Ours is an input-focused policy. It rewards companies and investors and groups that provide the inputs that are necessary to create a free and high-growth society. And basically, you just change the BE scorecard. And you reward a company for its contribution to fixed investment, to employment, to tax payments, and to exports. Those are the basis upon which every successful economy is built. And we just reward that. It's frightening to think that in a country with that 50% youth unemployment rate, you cannot win BEE points for creating jobs. You can only win those points for socially engineering your suppliers and your management team and your staff.
And an attempt to do that social engineering almost always ends up in people falsifying the sort of system, because that's really what's happened.
The whole thing becomes a fraud. And my colleagues that do a lot of the sort of sales and briefings, we do a lot of scenario planning, a lot of colleagues that spend time sitting in boardrooms, say that the size of the BE certificate we see in the foyer is usually inversely proportional to the number of blacks we're likely to encounter in the boardroom. And it's amazing for us how firms that rack up perfect or very acceptable BE scores actually demonstrate no real black decision makers within the business or the company in question. What's quite important in our anti-BE work is that I disagree very much with a group I have a lot of respect for, and I'm a member of AfriForum, which tries to make the BE fight about what it does to whites. I actually think that if there is a beneficiary of black economic empowerment policy, it is the whites. It was made clear to the white psyche after 94, and BE reinforced the message that this is not a state that's going to do anything for you. If you want to make it, you've got to do it on your own. And matched with access, a better access to a global economy and very high skills base, and perhaps that sort of deep-seated Calvinist thing, whites did extremely well. And we can actually prove it in the data that come very close to the proof that if you take white living standards over in blocks of 20 years since the end of the Boer War, whites did better in the most recent 20 years than in any 20-year block, including that one into the 1960s when whites became middle class. So I don't think BE is a problem because of what it does to the whites. Quite the contrary,
If you challenge a group, they often, if they overcome the adversity, they'll do so in great strength.
Yes. If you place groups under pressure, they perform. Look how courageously black South Africans fought the apartheid system. And the injustices and the corruption of that system under pressure. The entire concept, and it's why it's such a tragedy that socialism's got such a grip on thinking of young South Africans, that the state must somehow do it for you, I think is ultimately the reason why so many, mainly black South Africans, remain impoverished today. And you've got to break out of that psyche. And racial empowerment policies have such a grip on economic policy making in the country and policy making generally that if you cannot break the racial basis of policy formation, you cannot break South Africa's structural unemployment or poverty problems, which is why we invest so much time in pushing this EED alternative over BEE. It's very important to have an alternative. Because if you don't have one, people can get away with saying, yes, we know, as you will read now in the media, more than before, yes, we know BE has flaws, but there's nothing better, so we must do it. It's almost an argument that's also used by the political opposition. We want to put South Africans in a position where there is an alternative. And you can say we rather chose the corrupt and ineffective race-based BE policy over EED because we actually prefer it. Very important to create that choice.
But I do believe you published a survey in this regard where you did a polling of a few thousand people to survey their views on meritocracy or race-based quotas, and you found that most people do not actually believe in BEE as a system.
We do an enormous amount of social and economic research, and I'm privy to a lot of opinion polling data that's done in the country. And the thing that strikes you almost every day is just how far removed from reality the national debates on the country are. The race war is imminent. It is just around the corner, is a typical one, and it just doesn't fly. Opinion polling helps us get to the truth. We ask ordinary people straightforward questions about what they want and they think, and the results completely contradict a lot of what you'll read in media headlines and certainly almost everything that appears on Twitter. Twitter's almost the opposite of what people think in a society.
What did you say before we started the show? Twitter?
Just because it happens on Twitter doesn't mean it's real. What the most recent survey results we've been publishing this year, and let's start with race relations itself. We do very little work on race relations directly, and in the end, everything we do is race relations, but specifically nothing. And we find in a recent opinion poll, coming after this very difficult sort of start to the year that started with the sort of sparrow question and all of that, that 85% of South Africans across all race groups believe that there's far more to gain from working together for a common future than going it alone, completely contradicting the sense that race war is sitting just around the corner. Probably the most interesting stuff coming out of polling of this year, released this year, is that South Africans do disagree on critical points, such as should we have quotas in sport, but the disagreements are often broader within race groups than they are between race groups.
So explain that a bit, because, I mean, that's quite relevant at the moment in regards to, you know, we're not getting sports tournaments now.
You know, it's that threat that's delivered by politicians, that if we don't transform, there will be if we don't do land reform, there'll be a revolution. If we don't transform the Springbok rugby team, there'll be some sort of... It's never articulated exactly what it will be, some sort of negative consequences, sort of allusion to violence almost. And it's nonsense. Asking the question, do you think that sports teams should be selected purely on merit or on quotas? Great majority of black South Africans say purely on merit. That's not to say that a great deal more mustn't be done for sports development, which is something that rugby's authorities and South African school system and the sports minister have failed to do, but we don't think it should be them to do it. In any case, because we think that the entire system of schooling should be privatized.
Yeah, stop expecting the state to save you from yourself.
But the point is that a comment made by a political leader, such as that there must be draconian action now against rugby authorities because sport hasn't transformed, and this is on the nerves of the majority of the country's people, and I'm acting as their representative. The poll suggests that that's not the case. South Africans are far more moderate in their views of each other right across the spectrum and far more willing to work together and actually far more sensible than many of their political representatives.
But that's inherent irony, though. I mean, as soon as people do make a statement that there is a revolution around the corner, okay, they do it for two reasons. Number one, because they will lose power if there is a real revolution. And number two, it's just deeply, deeply patronizing to the people who vote for them. They want, I believe they do try create, you know, the dangers around the corner to bolster their own power, if we're really honest.
Yeah, I remember in around mid-2007, we'd written something in Business Day. I forget what. And Thabo Mbeki or someone in his office had, we used to have sparring battles with Mbeki. Had replied and said that what we'd written was undermining the National Democratic Revolution. And we published a letter a day or so later in Business Day saying to Mr. Mbeki that we thought the National Democratic Revolution was very much alive, that it was likely to grow in influence over the next 6 months and should have unseated him by the end of the year, which it subsequently did. So I agree completely with you. By the time we are talking about revolutions, very often it is because the fear is the revolution is being directed at me. The great revolutionary, of course, Blaydon Zimande in South Africa. I mean, he's been calling for revolution since day one, and there were those wonderful television images of him in Parliament when the students stormed the precinct, of him standing in that little barred window with his little microphone trying to talk to the students while they threw water bottles at him. And the scenario that he couldn't foresee. The revolution was happening, and it was standing at his front door. And ultimately, the calls to revolutionary violence always eventually turn on the dominant political power. And I think in the case of the ANC, the realization is starting to dawn among some of its better people that all this revolutionary stuff is dangerous. Rhodes must fall, became Zuma must fall. The student protest ended up at the union buildings and ended up at Parliament.
Fees must fall.
Fees must fall became an anti-ANC platform eventually. And in the end, unchecked, caused the revolution ends up with ANC leaders figuratively being hung from the lampposts outside Lithuli House, and that's where it will end for them. And that takes us to another interesting discussion about South Africa today. I think that realization is starting to catch on within parts of the ANC, opening up a whole lot of very interesting new options for the country.
So, all right, so let's get into that, because you guys have sort of forecast kind of where we might be going. So, sort of situational planning.
Yeah, we do. We're scenario planners. We do a huge amount of scenario planning. Very different methodology to forecasting. A forecaster is telling you that as we're going to reach a specific point in future space and time. He'll tell you what will happen. Scenario planners are doing a different thing. They are sketching what could plausibly happen. Forecasting approach is great, but it's fatal. And it's fatal because the architect of modern scenario planning, a Frenchman called Pierre Wack, who worked for Shell and called the oil crisis in 1973, Wack said forecasting only, forecasting is popular because it's usually right. But it's only right because the world it's based on hasn't yet changed. When that world changes fundamentally, the forecaster has nothing and must go back and create another forecast. Scenario planners are sketching alternative futures, each of which methodology has got its origins in complex systems theory, and each scenario of which has to be regarded as equally plausible. And it forces people to consider alternative futures that they didn't think could happen. And when we go and see clients and talk about scenarios, some of them, and one on the ANC we'll get to now, are quite way out. And we tell them the story about the 15th of August 1985, which was the night of the Rubicon speech, when amidst the economic catastrophe, Pierre Verbeurte tells the National Party, I will not lead white South Africa down the path of abdication and suicide. Chase Manhattan's rolled over our loans, conscripts, conflicts in townships. A decade later, the last leaders of the National Party have joined the ANC, and it's the last leader will eventually become the ANC's tourism minister. No forecast can get you there, but scenario planning can.
All right, so where does scenario planning put us?
Applying similar methods today, we run four scenarios for South Africa, and they hinge on two decisions. Does South Africa remain a free and open society, yes or no? Does South African ruling authorities, whoever they might be in the future, do they turn right to macroeconomic conservatism? Or do they persist surely now in the face of the evidence with the idea that the socialist developmental state can succeed? That gives us four options. We plot those two decisions on a matrix. The best case is South Africa remains free and open and the government turns right. We call that the wide road scenario. In this one, what has happened is the African National Congress's more pragmatic leaders start to connect the dots between low growth, the fiscal deficit, the high current account deficits, the youth unemployment rate.
Matthews pauses and the Tito Mboweni.
No, not at all. That, I think, is one of the mistakes that's being made. People are looking at the cliche ANC leaders.
Okay, so who are we looking at?
We're looking at hardcore, hardline, ruthless leaders. Very often they'd be found on the left of the party. Mm-hmm. And under pressure, they turn right. The model, if it occurs, may be something along the lines of what Lee Kuan Yew pulled off in Singapore after 1958, or what later inspiring the reforms of Deng Xiaoping in China, which pulled China out of the catastrophe of the Maoist era and into becoming this dominant
capitalist force.
And we think there is far more anarchic capitalism, far more capitalism, full stop, on the go in China today than you're likely to find in Washington. And that happened, and both Li and Deng are powerful nationalist socialist leaders that turn. It's a mistake to look to the Ramaphosas and those. They might be useful on the way. But to turn a society, you have to be a ruthless leader. So that's the first qualification. Ruthlessness, The second one is weighing up the odds of persisting with failed policies as opposed to turning. In the wide road scenario, we remain largely a free and open society because the ANC wins a popular mandate for change. And there's a very important piece of information we use in making that argument. It's a relationship that we've seen between opinion polls done by the presidency and the change in the real disposable income of households. South Africa's presidency does opinion polling, has been doing it for about 20 years, and asks very interesting questions. And one question is, do you have confidence in the government? And when we looked at what drives that answer, the poll has shown a fall in confidence from 80% in the middle 2000s to below 50% today. The indicator that drives that answer the closest is change in the real disposable income of households more than anything else. If people get richer, they are likely to answer that they're more confident in government. Not the government had anything to do with them becoming richer, it's just what they answer. When they get poorer, they lose confidence and they start to latch on to scandals, such as the current Gupta scandal, because they're looking for a reason why they're poor. And they find it in the scandal because they can understand it, they latch onto it, and that becomes pressure for government. Therefore, if the ANC turns right economically, it will see its opinion polls pick up again and we might become a sort of somewhat free and open society with a high growth economy. The next to that scenario sits what we call the narrow road. Again, this ruthless ANC leadership, probably coming out of its socialist left, realizes it has to turn. I mean, they've run out of the money to implement their policies. I realize this. At the same time, they...
Sorry, your mic has just dropped. You got it?
I've got it back, I think.
Yeah, at the same time,
the idea of being a Western liberal type of society is so repulsive to them that they're likely to force that right-wing reform through destroying democratic institutions and becoming more an authoritarian type of anarcho-capitalist society, much as Singapore later inspired China to become. And that narrow road scenario is the polar opposite of what people thought South Africa was in 1994. They thought it's a free and open society, and later became increasingly of the view now, especially with a somewhat stalling economy, it's going to become a high-growth economy and it's going to become a lot less of a free and open society. Both scenarios are interesting because they presuppose or suggest that the current ANC leadership, for all the scandal and turmoil that follows it around day after day, can turn South Africa around and pull it off within a decade. And a lot of audiences look at us with wide eyes and say, you know, we know you guys and you've worked with us for years and that's why we're listening to this, but it sounds a bit far-fetched. And that's why we told them the story about the move from the Rubicon speech in Pierre to Martinus van Schalkwyk a decade later. The world changes really, really quickly and few people anticipate the speed and the nature of change. That's why you get the North African uprisings, it's largely unpredicted. That's why you're able to move from the civil rights movement in America in the 1960s to the black man in the White House within a short matter of decades, something people would have found very unlikely. There are two other scenarios. Both of them hinge on the ANC not turning right economically. In the rocky road, they persist with failed socialist ideas, and as they begin to realize, which they already do, that they could lose a future election, they turn to rabid racial nationalism and the destruction of democratic institutions, and South Africa's 20-year future is written for it. The fourth scenario, and there's no fifth one, is what we call the toll road. The ANC persists in failed policies. They fail to meet the expectations of people. And for some reason, South Africa's remained a free and open enough society for the ANC to lose a future election. It loses the election in 2024. Setting South Africa up for a new, wildly unstable period of coalition government, when between the EFF, the DA, and the ANC, a new government will have to be formed and set about meeting the expectations of increasingly, fortunately, skeptical South African public, who are not likely to give governments the carte blanche and the endorsement and the confidence that the ANC was granted in 1994.
So, Franz, what are you saying? You are saying basically that the ANC could very well be our so-called savior. Do you believe that I mean, there are many pragmatic people within it, unfortunately, that they don't come out publicly to say anything because the ANC is a broad church. But if you had to make a prediction, what would it be?
Yeah, look, that's always the first question when we finish talking. And so we've got a good answer for it. We say, firstly, don't believe what we're about to say, because forecasting methods don't work in volatile emerging markets. So the forecast we're about to give you is probably not the one that's going to materialize. I think the odds are that the ANC is going to let the opportunity to reform slip through its fingers for two reasons. One, there are too many hardline ideologues for whom it is just a bridge too far. It's a great story of the frog and the scorpion trying to cross the river, and the scorpion says to the frog, "Will you give me a lift on your back?" And the frog says, "You're crazy, you'll sting me." And the scorpion says, "But why?" "Because then I'd also drown." And the frog says, "Well, that makes sense." The scorpion hops on, and halfway across, the scorpion stings the frog.
Yeah.
As they're both sinking, the frog says to the scorpion, "You know, what the hell was that?" And the scorpion says, "I'm a scorpion, and that's what scorpions do."
Yeah.
So I think that's the likelihood. They're not going to meet popular expectations. I think they're going to essentially lose an election within the next decade. And I think that's going to give rise to a very peculiar series of bedfellows in a coalition government. That's the 75% likelihood as we sit here today. 25% likelihood is that the reformist wing of the party, coming out of its hardline left, not the right — they'll win the support of the right later — is going to pull off a remarkable turnaround, and South Africa is going to be a 5% growth economy with rapidly falling unemployment by the end of the decade. The mistake you make is to write off the minority scenario because it sounds too incredulous, and you miss significant opportunities for South Africa if you do that. Although on current trends, the more rocky road scenario beckons, unfortunately.
Yeah,
but here there. A wax warning on why current trends are so dangerous, because when they break, fundamentally countries move into different paradigms. And just try and put yourself in the position of the ANC, NEC at the moment. What must a meeting be like? You can't fill a stadium. Even the Democratic Alliance is trying to fill stadiums. I mean, when did sort of liberal sort of society start filling stadiums? I mean, how have you lost control of the country? The EFF packs out stadiums. You don't have the money to implement your grandiose socialist schemes of national health insurance and free education and building new universities and all sorts of other things. The comrades who are looting the fiscus don't actually have the CapEx projects anymore to do that with. Your opinion polls have turned against you. It's my great friend Davy Ruart has a wonderful quote about Hemingway, who writes about the man who goes bankrupt. And people say to him, "How did that happen?" And the man says, "Well, first slowly and then very fast." And political parties lose control in the same way. And the ANC is now in the very fast. The great story is about senior ANC leaders arriving to go on the campaign trail, and the police say to them, "If you go into this neighborhood, we suggest you campaign from inside the Inyala, because we think the people will tear you to pieces if you walk in the streets." Now, for the ANC, that arrogance of being the people, the view, the manifestation of the will of the majority of the people, to be told they're effectively no-go areas, to be ridiculed in Parliament day after day by the collective opposition, to face the headlines they're facing in Sunday papers at the moment, scandal after scandal. Take that to your board meeting and have a discussion about where things are headed. Maybe that conservative right-wing economic reform then starts to gain a bit of traction within the movement. And if it does gain the traction, they're not the first. There'll be one of a series, mainly Asian at first. This is where the trend really starts in the 70s and 80s. Economies that came out of similar catastrophes to become economic powerhouses by adopting sensible policies. And for that reason, maybe my sense that the up case only has 25% is a little bit pessimistic.
Just wondering, you know, to me it seems a lot of what's stopping the ANC from kind of having what we would view as sort of sense and turning away from the rocky road, because I feel to some extent they're already on the rocky road, you know, the sort of going against democratic institutions like the public protector, doing things like that. I'm not convinced the IEC is that IEC anymore. So these kinds of things, but I'm wondering the effect that a party like the EFF is having on those types of decisions, because it's almost if the ANC moves to the right, as you say, the problem is they lose the populist left, which is what the EFF almost universally appeals to. And I feel like the whole of politics across all the parties, DA, EFF and ANC, the rest don't really matter, has moved left. The DA has gone, all right, we got all the middle class guys. We now need to start being a bit populist. The DA, the ANC seeing the EFF members, a lot of their members moved to the EFF with this populist sort of rhetoric coming from Julius Malema. I'm just wondering what effect you think that has, or if any, if you think I've got any of that right.
I think it's a patronizing lack of imagination on the part of political leaders that to appeal to the poor and to appeal to the unemployed, you need to kind of dumb down your ideas. It comes out very clear out of the opinion polling that South Africans don't want more dependency, they don't want more welfare, they want jobs and the independence that comes with it. I don't think any of the political parties that are around at the moment actually have the courage to go out and appeal to what people really want. And you're not seeing parties appealing to what people want. You're seeing parties appealing to their narrow prejudices about what they think poor people might be able to understand, which is we'll give you more welfare and we'll give you more BEE. Now, you can probably find that result in opinion polls if you look for it. You can say to people, do you want more welfare and more BEE? And they'll say yes. And you'll say, well, in that case, what must we do as a political party? It's the same as asking the question in an opinion poll, do you bath every day? And someone will say no, and you'll make draw inferences from that, but the chap only has a shower in his house. So there's a total lack of imagination. Also, surely it is the role of leaders within any society, if you want to have a society led by leaders, which is a discussion for another day, to actually not become what I think has started to happen in the political opposition as well. It's a party that says there go the people, and as their leader we must follow them. Have the courage to actually put across a fundamentally different, bold set of new ideas that capture the imagination of people. The ANC has afforded the opposition a unique opportunity to do this. You could not have a governing party that does more damage to itself than the ANC does. It's every single day of the week. It is from scandal to crisis to catastrophe and back again. And I don't think the political opposition is exploiting this sufficiently. I think a fundamental different set of policies, boldly articulated by DA leader Maimane, who I think is one of the few politicians with a great measure of charisma, perhaps going back to Fancel Slabbert, who had any charisma. If anyone's able to articulate a bold new vision, you need a guy that can actually pull it off. And Maimane has got the ability to do that, and I think it's such a pity that the party hasn't been bold enough in driving an alternative set of ideas around key questions such as empowerment policy. If they had, I think they might have seen.
Well, I don't think anyone knows where the DA stands on empowerment at the moment.
No, two, 3 years back, they said we want many black millionaires, but not two or three black billionaires, right? They want a broader economic empowerment policy.
They've reversed a couple of times, and I think they're stuck. They're stuck between sort of going with the just yes to BEE and sort of going, well, we've seen BEE and the problems that are there. So, and I agree with you, it is proposing something. But you've got a party like the EFF saying, who are basically campaigning on the AMC's campaigning is race, the EFF's campaigning is land. So, and maybe that is very lazy, but it does seem to be drawing some attention there. Can we talk about land reform? You know, is it such a big thing to people?
No. In fact, in these latest polls we did, we asked an open-ended question. They're very useful. What would it take for your life to be better? I mean, anyone can answer it. It's a great leveler of a question. I think 2.2% of people mentioned land reform. And yet you're told that if it's not for land reform, there'll be some sort of revolution. I don't think it's the case at all. Land represents now about 2.5% of GDP. Agriculture, I think, has come about 30,000 businesses, a number that we think should, over 20 years, reduce to about 5,000 to make it competitive, and the economies of scale to produce food cheaply and employs about 500,000 people. Take all those numbers and tell me how that's going to solve a crisis where 8.5 million people do not have jobs or employment or any economic activity. The maths on land reform just doesn't follow. The only debate on land reform that actually has any traction is not an economic debate, it's an ideological one.
That we
want to take it back, and take it back from whom and across what eras are questions that are seldom brought out in sufficient detail in the media. But land reform on its own offers zero chance of a better life any South Africans. The only outcome you're likely to get on land reform is you worsen circumstances for great majority of people through hiking food prices and destroying these economic centerpieces, the businesses that keep rural economies together, and therefore accelerating flow of people into urban areas that already, because of low growth and lack of employment opportunities, cannot meet demands from the existing flow of people. Land reform is a lose-lose-lose outcome. Why does a party like the EFF push it, therefore? There's some pretty bright guys sitting in the EFF. It isn't a group of ignoramuses. I think there are, at times in evolution of countries, you come across sinister political leaders. Those who realize that they will profit immensely from chaos, conflict, and instability. And I think the EFF is one of those parties. I don't for a moment think anyone, including EFF leader Julius Malema, thinks land reform is going to improve anyone's social, economic circumstances. But in destroying the property rights basis of our society, you destroy individual and human freedoms, because property rights underpins human freedom. And absolutely, that's why it's so important. It's not an economic question. Property rights, the economic question is secondary. It's the human freedom question. If your property is secure and no one can take it from you, there's nothing else they can do to you. They can't take away your freedom of speech or thought or association, but allow them to take away the basis of the business or the wealth that sustains you, and they can intimidate you into dropping all your ideas, your associations, your political views, and the like. And that's why property rights are so important. And when a party like the EFF, which has some very bright guys in it, push a pointless, a dead horse of land reform as they do, the reason is not social upliftment. It's not that they actually think it can work. It's that they understand that that's necessary to become the kind of draconian society that they envisage for South Africa.
Frans, I mean, listening to this, I mean, I agree with you on everything you said so far. What boggles my mind is why no one else has been able to articulate these things like you. I mean, if I don't read popular media on purpose for this very reason, all I read is land reform and racism and who knows what else, other things. But you're telling a story that shows ordinary South African citizens are actually deeply reasonable. And you won't find that anywhere else.
It's not reflected in.
We make a point on each podcast that individuals are reasonable. Individual wants shelter, food, relationships, sex, a job. Everyone has those goals by, you know, far and large. Why is that not being promoted in media or in government? Why can't the ANC just say, look, we've done so well for you, actually, considering. Why doesn't the DA, you know, make the same point? All they do is attack the ANC, but they don't say, we've made you more free. We've made you able to get a job or to get what you want or to... Anyway, I'm ranting. Why hasn't this message been portrayed?
I think I've been doing this for about 10 years now, pushing this message, and I know all the other people that pushed the message, and we could all fit into your little studio here. And between us, we receive a frighteningly modest amount of funding to do this with. It's very difficult at times to get these ideas into the media. You can get them in, but it takes a vast amount of effort to do that. My group is now placing about 150 opinion articles a year in the mainstream media, and we're starting to get there. But we're up against, it's really, to some extent, a David and Goliath struggle. The other side of the debate, the socialist left, are incredibly well-resourced. Vast numbers of lobby groups, activists, and think tanks, huge amounts of money pouring into those organizations. Often out of corporate South Africa, CSI spending indirectly. I think organizations such as the Ford Foundations and others have been hijacked eventually. I know of a very interesting funding group in the US which has set a, coming out of a very rich American businessman, who has instructed his heirs to spend all his lobbying money within, I think, a period of 20 years. Because he knows that the history is that these groups get set up by these industrialists and get hijacked by the left and turned against them eventually. He doesn't want it to last more than that, so it can't be hijacked. I think that's part of the reason. But ultimately, I think what it comes down to is that those with a stake in the maintenance of a capitalist system, comes down just to that, are seldom sufficiently motivated to fight for the system. And therefore they allow it to be attacked time and time and time again. In the end, whoever wins this debate is quite simple. It's the one that put the most information into the public system, the most convincing information. At the moment, too little conservative ideas entering the public debate in the country, and too much socialist dogma. The result is the policy framework that we see for South Africa. Give the conservative right a massive amount of funding, and it almost is, it must be frank about these things, it would probably be possible to buy a different result in terms of public opinion. I don't think we should be shy of that. You said earlier that, you know, we think these are sensible ideas. It's not we think, these are sensible ideas. Because there is no example, you can go back over the last 100 years, of the alternative actually working. Mm. This is the only thing that works. It will deliver results. And activists for conservative ideas should not be shy about making that point, that they are right. The other side are wrong on the facts of it. There's no other way about it. We don't be polite, give each other a chance and hear the other side out.
Yeah, let's agree to disagree is bullshit.
The other side played itself out in Venezuela and Zimbabwe and Cambodia and the Soviet Union. It's there for the world to see. The products of conservatism built vast amounts of wealth that tracked very closely the reduction in poverty levels across the world, most notably in China and in Asia broadly over the last 20 years. And those points need to be made strongly and boldly. But as I said, the lobby for that in South Africa, the number of people involved would all fit into the studio.
So just on the conservatism point, because I think people hear that word, you know,
and they think apartheid was conservative.
Yeah. Oh, they're going to take away my rights to an abortion because that's conservative, or they're going to impose religion on me because that's conservative. So can we just clarify a little bit that that's not what we're talking about?
Well, apartheid was a socialist society. I mean, if you farmed with bananas, you had to sell them to the banana board. I mean, you don't get closer to socialist utopia than that. You're told what to do with your bananas. That's why it failed, which it did. When I started this, I used to struggle with the terminology as well. And there was a stage early on when I said, you know, we must be careful with terminology and not talk about being too liberal, too conservative, puts people off. And actually, to hell with that now. It being nice doesn't get you anywhere. You've got to be direct and upfront about what your ideas are and call them what they are. And in time, as the as the currency that carries the ideas of the other side of the debate falls apart, people will turn to you. And I think ultimately have the respect for the fact that you were willing throughout to say what you are, not to hide behind other terms and try and be nice and try and present a different view and try and slowly and almost sneakily bring the left on board by being careful. Be out there, be upfront, be direct about what you believe in. Because it's actually that upfrontness and aggression almost in pushing the message that explains the vast success of left-wing activists in selling their bankrupt ideology to poor people for whom that ideology offers no possible chance of a better life.
So I'm just going to also add to that that I think at the moment conservatism very much holds the view of freedom. It's about freedom. It's about liberty. So if you think otherwise, you're blatantly mistaken.
Conservatism is taken to its extreme is the height of individual liberty. You control your own future. The individual is all important. Short of you obstructing opportunities or threatening the futures of others, you're allowed to do and think and be whatever you like. Okay. Now, not for a moment does it extend to restrictions on abortion or the like. I think you're great. Tragedy, but also perhaps a rebirth of a conservatism in the United States will come about through Trump. I don't know where you chaps are on Mr. Trump, but I
love him. Don't always agree with him, but love him.
I think there's a measure of there's no word in English that's as good Afrikaans word skeynheiligheid in what Trump is busy doing in America.
It's Schadenfreude, I think.
I think it may do a fair amount of damage, but will force the rebirth of American conservatism in the model of what came really out of the Reagan era, which is what I think American conservatism needs to return to. South Africa's never really had a conservative movement because the Nats were such absolute socialists, and the ANC who took over from them in many respects pretended to be socialists, even though the gear policy was perhaps the most conservative macroeconomic policy written by a South African government. But we don't have that movement, and there's a sense of being almost afraid of it, of it being a dangerous idea. And I think far more might be gained by being upfront about it and seeing if that allows the movement to start attracting a growing number of recruits. In my own very small way, being aware of who's who, I think that's starting to happen. And more and more young people, by no means a flood, are expressing interest in these ideas and are, more importantly, prepared to stand up for those ideas. And that's quite an encouraging trend, I think, for our country.
Yeah, well, that hour was more packed with information than most other hours of my life, that's for sure. I'll need to listen to this one two or three times to really get to the nub of the idea. But, Franz, this has been absolutely invaluable, really. Thank you very much for coming through. Your ideas are fantastic, and they're informed. Who would have thought well-informed ideas could actually take hold in this society of ours?
Yeah, I agree. I think a bit of a mind-blown type of stuff, but I think let's try expand the small group of people that would only fit into this room, and if you're listening to the podcast, then have these discussions when you sit around dinner tables, when you speak to friends. Don't be afraid to stand by your views, and believing in individual freedoms and liberty, there's nothing wrong with that. It's something to be proud of.
And I do implore our listeners to please go to the Institute of Race Relations. All their research is available. Become a subscriber. You really would not be disappointed. A lot of valuable information there.
Just to close up, Franz, you want to just plug a little bit of your Twitter account or the Institute of Race Relations, etc.?
Yeah, if you're looking for us, irr.org.za, that's probably the place to go. And if you look for us on Twitter, you'll find us there. We're fairly active. And if you are anyone, particularly a younger person interested in these ideas, want to find a home, we're very interested in talking to you.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been the Renegade Report. We will catch you next time. Thank you.
Cliffcentral.com. I've got something important to tell you. Cliffcentral.com.